Have you ever wished that you had a direct line to your pediatrician to ask all the questions that constantly crop up while parenting? We sure have. That's why we launched the Bites of Health podcast. Every morning, we'll answer a commonly asked pediatric question in 5 minutes or less. You can tune in while you're making your second cup of coffee or from the school drop-off line. So be sure to tune in to Bites of Health, streaming now.
Soundsington Media.
Where do our fears come from? For some of us, it's past experiences. Others, maybe a fear of the unknown. But if you're anything like the team at Unspookable, there is one man responsible for many of the characters, illustrations, and creatures. Be it cartoon cat, anxious dog, long horse, or siren head, that just give us the shivers. We're of course talking about writer and illustrator Trevor Henderson. Unspookable producer Nate Dufort had the chance to sit down with Trevor to talk about creating creatures in the age of the internet, his new book, Scare Waves, and so much more on this episode of Unspookable.
Nate Dufort, producer and creator of Unspookable here, and I'm very excited for today's guest. For our listeners, can you introduce yourself and what it is that you do?
My name is Trevor Henderson. I'm an illustrator and writer who lives and works in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. And over the last, 5 or 6 years, I've kind of become known for making monsters that kind of go a little viral online. I've made characters like Siren Head and Cartoon Cat and Long Horse, usually through the medium of kind of photo bashing, where I paint onto photography of like spooky locations that people either send me or I take myself. And I just wrote a middle grade kids book called Scare Waves with Scholastic that just hit shelves on October 3rd. That is just like chock-a-block full of monsters.
I'm super excited to talk about Scare Waves. I'm about halfway into it right now. But first, I can't not bring this up. So you know that we've covered one of your creations on Unspookable in the past, Siren Head, one of our most requested topics by our listeners. And our listeners have suggested even more of your creations. Does it ever surprise you to see your work pop up across other media?
Oh, constantly. When I first made these characters, and even now when I'm still doing art, it's just something I personally would like to see and what that would look like. So whenever there's a response where fans really take to a character and start giving it all this life that I never really planned for, it is very mind-boggling to me. Like Siren Head, I painted in 2018, and then it wasn't until like 2 years later that it really blew up and became viral. And the way that fans, especially younger audiences, have run with that character and gone in all kinds of crazy directions is really cool and weird and a little scary, but more than anything, just kind of like really, I'm really thankful that I made a character that seems to resonate so well, especially with kids. You know, I hear about how, you know, a friend of a friend who that I work, like I'll be working on a illustration job with somebody and they'll be like, you know, my best friend has a kid and that kid is on the playground and heard about like people just like passing around like urban legends among kids about Siren Head and how Siren Head's going to get you. And it's like become like this weird sort of modern schoolyard boogeyman in some ways, which is just the coolest thing in the world.
It's amazing. And we talk about it all the time on the show, just how digital folklore has changed oral tradition and how big visuals are a component in that. And that kind of being that sweet spot of where you hit.
Yeah.
Changing gears, though, to the book, Scare Waves, out now for middle grade audiences. What can you tell us about this story?
Yeah, so Scare Waves is kind of my take on a personally beloved subgenre of kids versus monsters. I read Stephen King's It at a very, very young age, and it's left a big indentation, meteor strike in my brain ever since. So it's a kids versus monsters kind of story set in the 90s in a small town called Beacon Point that has a long history of people going missing, strange sightings of things in the woods, odd lights in the sky, all kinds of phenomena that kind of gets brushed aside, generally gets ignored by the adults in town just because it's easier to go about your daily life and not really worry about it. It's somebody else's problem. But the kids are very aware of it, and it follows a group of kids, including a new girl in town, kind of like a recluse kid who lives on a farm outside town, people from all walks of life, as they start to realize that there are different monsters picking off kids in this town, and each of them has their own monster that's after them. And the first part of the book is very almost like an anthology sort of thing where it chronicles different kids dealing with a monster and, you know, either living or not. And then about the midpoint on, some of the kids get together and kind of like exchange notes. And they're like, oh, we better do something about this. And it becomes kind of like a mission to get evidence, try and get parents to pay attention and just try and survive. And it's just loaded with monsters. I think there's 8 different monsters because I really wanted to give kids what they responded to with my online work. A similar thing in the book. And I just hope people like it. It's what I would have wanted to read when I was, you know, just hoovering up R.L. Stine and Stephen King and like all the weird knockoffs to Goosebumps that came out around the same time when I was a kid. And yeah, it's going to be in Scholastic Book Fairs, which is what my favorite thing was when I was a kid. And I just hope it does well with a young audience.
You know, as I'm reading like about Beacon Point, it's really pulling me in. I feel like, oh, you've got such a great job describing this small town and then also the very wide and very real divide between the kids and the parents. Was Beacon Point based on anywhere in particular, like from your own universe, or was it completely a product of your imagination?
Yeah, it's a combination of a lot of different things. In general, the town is influenced by, so me and my partner, Jen Woodall, we go to this comics festival in Bethesda, Maryland, every year, called SPX. And we drive there because the drive is always really nice that time of year. And we always stop in this weird small town that really left a big impression on both of us. And we thought it was called Battery, Pennsylvania. So we have all these memories of this town, you know, has like one of the last little video stores, like with VHS tapes. It's very small and weird and quaint and with a big factory on the side of town, lots of trees. And then we went back this year and most of that was just totally made up in our heads. It's not actually called Battery. I don't think there actually is a place called Battery. So it was kind of like half this made up town that we kind of together came up with from driving through a small town and just misremembering everything. And then to that end, I also like put in like, you know, there's a video store that is my video store from when I grew up in Oshawa, the Video Wiz, like the big theater that I used to go to, like all these different things from myself growing up in a small town outside of Toronto, Canada, just kind of plugged in there. And then just kind of like just the vibe of, because I love small town horror in fiction and movies and games and all that. So I just tried to put that kind of atmosphere over top, and it became like a combination of those things.
You know, middle graders seem like such an ignored audience. They find content maybe not originally intended for them. And yeah. I think you and I may share a lot of influences, you know, talking about Stephen King, R.L. Stine, and just being able to grow up when there were, you know, VHS or DVD stores and be able to walk through that aisle that became our church.
Absolutely.
But why, at this point in your career, focus this book for middle graders? What made you want to write for this age range?
Well, it was something I'd thought about before, but nothing I'd really, put into motion. And Scholastic actually reached out to me and asked if I'd ever considered it. And I said, yes, of course, you know, because I distinctly remember being that kid who, you know, was just loves monsters, loves horror, and was just reading everything I possibly could. And yeah, the big draw was to have a book on those same shelves, like the Scholastic Book Fair. Really means a lot to me personally, because like I mentioned, it was like a holiday. And just the idea of like, I was aware of the kid audience that had popped up over the last couple of years, last three or four years, like something that I think is incredible, but I never aimed for. I never put any work into the world that was specifically aimed at middle graders before this. So I wanted to do something that could you know, be in the same hallowed halls as the Goosebumps books and kind of fill a gap in that way for newer kids who are looking for the same sort of thing. And just kind of like being appreciative to the kid audience that really loves my work. And, you know, without actually, you know, it's for middle grade audiences, but I made a very conscious effort to not pull any punches, to not talk down, to not condescend, because I think it's really easy for kids to kind of tell when the scares are being held back because, you know, cognizant of them being younger. So I just, thankfully, Scholastic was on the same page. They never were no notes about pulling anything back, making anything a little bit tamer. And yeah, just wanted to, you know, give kids a safe scare.
I know it might be early with the book just having been recently released, but based on the amazing critical reception so far, do you think there's a future? Are you going to try and write more for this audience base?
Yeah, well, I don't know if you have a physical copy or an EPUB, but the physical copy does have a one on the spine. It's because it was optioned as two books. So there's definitely going to be a second one. I've sent off a plot synopsis that I think is really interesting and really fun to Scholastic. And I'm sure it's being passed around there. I hope it gets approved because I think it would be really wild. It's kind of my take on body horror and UFO stuff for kids, sort of.
Oh.
If there's a second, if the response is as good as the first book has been so far for the second book, I would be over the moon if they came back and asked for a book three or a book four, because they're very, very fun to write, and I have ideas for more, and I just love to continue to put the characters through the ringer.
Amazing. That's super exciting as a fan for me to hear. You know, you have such a specific area of expertise. I'm wondering what you can share about your creative process. Where do these ideas come from?
It's odd because there isn't really a huge creative process. Like I actually do a lot less than I think most people do. The whole thing with the photo bashing, which is where all the characters I'm kind of known for came from, was because up until very recently, I was working retail every single day. I've worked retail most of my life, haven't been able to jump to freelance, you know, until like the last 5 years or so. But for the longest time, I would come home from working in a bookstore, working in a video store, whatever I was doing, and be really tired and not want to paint a whole thing, but wanting to keep putting work out on social media to keep your engagement up high and, you know, keep being productive as an artist, you know? So what I would do for a long period of time with those is that I had a big folder of photos and I could choose from those when I came home and was tired. I wouldn't have to paint a whole background. I wouldn't have to do all this and that. I could just focus on creature design and matching and lighting and color and tone and shadow, just trying to fit a monster into an environment that was already pre-existing. And it let me focus on just like what I would like to see in terms of creature design and, you know, character design and that kind of thing. Yeah, that was where all of that came from. And I don't know where the monster designs came from, but I was, you know, all the really popular ones, when they came about, I was doing like four or five a day. I was just pumping them out. And I made a point not to do any pre-sketch. I never pre-sketch or do anything like that. I just start painting right on the photo. And then after it's done, try and contextualize a little bit with a little bit of flash fiction, a little text, and put it out there and be done with it and move on to the next one. So that's kind of the extent of the process. I just kind of try and see what would fit in that space when I'm looking at a spooky photo, and then what I would find scary and what I think would be interesting or, you know, cool to see. And that's where Siren Head and Long Horse and all the rest of those guys came from.
A follow-up question, yeah. Be it inspiration or technique or platforms, do you have any advice for young creators that might be listening, maybe the future Trevor Hendersons of tomorrow?
Yeah, well, I mean, first off, anyone who's drawing because they like my stuff, like, you're a hero. That's the coolest thing in the world. Like, I just want to inspire kids to do something that I can't even, that's way cooler than what I'm doing. Like, I just know that, you know, there's all these, you know, I hear about people who are drawing monsters and doing horror art and creature stuff now, and I just know it's going to be like, it knock my stuff out of the water, and it just makes me so happy to be, you know, a part of that. But for people looking for any advice, I guess just try and draw what scares you in terms of creatures, and be very conscious of shapes and what shapes you're giving characters. Like I try and think of silhouettes, you know, and if a character or a monster would be identifiable if it was just a black silhouette, could you still tell it? And if you can't, then, you know, try and break up your shapes a little bit more, something like that. And just, you know, try and incorporate things you find interesting, things that scare you, things you maybe haven't seen before in an interesting way. And practice is the other one. I just do them, just pump them out, do as many as you can, I guess.
That is great advice. Yeah, we love to eliminate barriers wherever possible. So we really appreciate that advice. More after this.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
So we've already mentioned some of the big ones, but thinking back to being in the target age of our listenership, like what were some other big or maybe lesser known, you know, horror media pieces that inspired you?
Yeah, well, I think when I was a kid, I followed a very similar pipeline to a lot of people working in horror these days, which was, you know, the R.L. Stein, the Goosebumps from the Scholastic Book Fair, all the weird like knockoffs, like Spine Tinglers and things like that. I somehow never jumped onto Fear Street. I think at the time it seemed like it was more focused on like less supernatural stuff. So I didn't really vibe with that at the time. So I sidestepped that completely. And then, you know, Stephen Gamel's illustrations in Alvin Schwartz's Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark books, of course, petrified me. I couldn't even look at them. And I was like, fascinated by them at the same time. The author who did... I know he did Last Summer. I was into that for, I think it might be Lois Duncan, I think. And then, you know, right on to Stephen King. And because my dad had all of those in the night table beside his bed. I remember reading The Mist at a really young age, Skeleton Crew. And then that just blew the doors open. And, you know, anything in the horror section at the library, I could read all the way up into and past high school. I think I read It for the first time in grade 7 or 8. And that just really... did a lot for me.
same.
Yeah.
What do you think it is about this age range that's so drawn to horror content or that feeling of being scared?
Yeah. Well, I think when you're that age, you're still trepidatious about it. It still has a kind of power over you that you're, you know, captivated by and you want to... see and read and get as much of, but at the same time, there's still that thrill. Like, you know, if a movie scares me these days, it's a wonderful surprise. But back then, you know, everything is kind of new. You're not used to tropes as much, that kind of thing. And it just has a vitality when you're that young that it maybe loses a little bit of it. All but the very best stuff, I think.
Looking at your huge body of work and some of your creations, so many of which our audience is familiar with, do you have any favorites yourself?
Yeah. The one I feel like there's 4 or 5 that really kind of became what I was known for, which is like, you know, a cartoon cat, Siren Head, maybe the man with the upside down face, a few others like that. Long Horse has always been my favorite, but it seems like it's maybe the least popular of the three, but it's like one of my big favorites. And for more obscure ones, there's a group of characters called the Sisters of the Ever-Sharpening Blade that are kind of like my version of maybe the Cenobites from Hellraiser, like these kind of Victorian women in dresses with veiled heads and like knife points coming out from their whatever their face looks underneath. And they're like this bizarre interdimensional cult of beings that you can call on for assassinations. I like those guys. I think they're cool. So I'd like to do something with them eventually. Like, I have some ideas for longer works involving some characters, and they're at the top of the list for sure.
That's awesome. So you mentioned before, you know, you have really come to fame because of the internet and your fans' ability to share your work. What are the pros and cons of being an artist and creator in the age of the internet and social media?
Yeah, well, it's mostly pros. I'm so happy and just so grateful that something I made has become so, you know, well known and liked and enough that people have taken it and run with it in all these really crazy ways. But, you know, the flip side, you know, in the beginning when the internet kind of took, like Siren Head, for instance, and it became very viral and went in its own direction, I had to learn very quickly that, you know, once the internet kind of takes something in that way, it's kind of not yours anymore. Like, you have to make peace with that very quickly. So yeah, I think you're right in that, you know, thankfully the fan base has been a huge, huge component of, you know, all the opportunities I've gotten, getting a chance to ride Scare Waves, all these characters kind of blowing up. But, you know, at the same time, I have to make peace that Siren Head is kind of the internet's now, like, more or less. A lot of people are very desperate for lore and, you know, a meaning behind characters. And I find, like, Siren Head specifically is always going to get less scary the more you know about it. So personally, I would have kept it very ambiguous. But there's, like, whole backstories and stuff out there now. You know, kids' videos with them, all kinds of stuff. So I guess the answer is that, you know, you get a wonderful, passionate fan base on one hand. On the other, you know, you get Siren Head playing soccer with Spider-Man and CGI yeah. videos for children made, you know, across the seas that you would not have expected, I guess.
Two super quick ones for you. I see as you're wearing a Bigfoot Lives t-shirt. If you could only pick one cryptid to be real, what would you choose and why?
Oh, it's a good question. My gut response is the Fresno Nightcrawlers, because those guys are just weird, wispy, ghostly walking pants. And I would just love them to be real. That would be great. But I also really like the Hopkinsville Goblins, which are just like horrible little gremlins. Or God, the Dover Demon is really cool. The Flatwoods Monster. Any of the stranger ones, really. Bigfoot, though, God, if they found a Bigfoot. See, I also don't want cryptids to be real because I know that they would just catch them and do horrible things to them. And we would be horrible to them. So if they do exist, I hope that I want a photo, but I want them to keep being mysterious and unfound, I guess. But definitely the Fresno Nightcrawlers, because they're just weird little guys.
I love it. And then I'll leave you on a fun one. I don't know your diet or dietary restrictions, but if you can only pick one,
yeah,
Count Chocula, Frankenberry, or Booberry?
See, this is a hard question because we don't really get those in Canada so much. So I've had Count Chocula for sure, and I'm not a big fan. But I haven't had Booberry, and I haven't had Frankenberry. So I think I'd go with Frankenberry because that seems like it's strawberry.
Yep. I think it's a strawberry or raspberry. And that's in big quotes, yeah. Strawberry or raspberry.
Yeah, yeah. But my real answer is that I would go with the non-existent Creature from the Black Lagoon themed cereal that he should have gotten back in the, you know, 70s or 80s or whenever they came up with it. He was done dirty. He deserves his own swampy green cereal that tastes like, you know, lemons or limes or something. I don't know.
Well, thank you so much for your time today here, Trevor.
Yeah, of course. No, I'm happy to. This is great.
Thank you, Nate. And a huge thanks to this week's guest, Trevor Henderson. Trevor's book, Scare Waves, is available now, wherever books are sold. Our theme song and additional music composed by Jesse Case. Our logo was created by Natalie Kewen. If you enjoy the show, make sure to tell your friends. You can leave us a rating and review in your podcast player of choice, or share an episode on social media. Speaking of social media, you can find Unspookable on Twitter and Instagram. Follow us for a peek behind the scenes and for updates on the show. Unspookable is a production of Soundsington Media, committed to making quality programming for young audiences and the young at heart. For more information on our shows and the people behind them, go to www.soundsingtonmedia.com.
Let Mysteries at Midnight be your destination for detective whodunits and captivating mystery stories. You'll hear classic stories like Sherlock Holmes, Agatha Christie's Poirot, and short tales from H.G. Wells, Charles Dickens, Edgar Allan Poe, and others. I'm Christopher, and I read these classic stories in the soothing style of a bedtime story, so you can listen to them in bed when you drift off to sleep. Search for Mysteries at Midnight on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app, and follow and subscribe so you don't miss out on new episodes.